Proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Dean Johnson. I'm an assistant public defender in Georgetown, Delaware. And I have, Your Honors, reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honor, there are two things, basically, that the appellant is asking of this court today. The first being that in order for there to be a conviction of terroristic threatening, that the speaker should have made a true threat. That is, that the speaker should have reasonably foreseen that his words would have been considered to be a serious expression of an intent to commit the crime. And second, regarding hate crimes, that we're asking this court to determine that to convict someone for a hate crime, that the person, that the defendant must have made a conscious decision to seek out the victim because of their race, national origin, and so on. And that, I believe, Your Honor, gets to the thrust of the term select under our statute. Prior to getting into both of those arguments, I would like to make an analogy, somewhat of a real-time analogy, that I think is appropriate to both terroristic threatening and to hate crime. That analogy is this. As Your Honors are aware, I'm a public defender, and in the course of a year, I see many hundreds of clients, very often under difficult situations. Those clients often are emotionally and physically upset. They have injustice sometimes perceived, sometimes real injustices have been entered against them. And we are very often placed with each other in a rather small interview room or cell area. In the course of those interviews, there are very often things said to me that are of a threatening nature. And there are often things said to me that impugn my actions and my intentions based upon my race. And my question then is, should that defendant sitting in that confined area, upset and traumatized, reasonably foresee that those remarks that he says to me would be considered a serious expression of an intent to commit a crime? And I think not, ladies and gentlemen. And second, has that person made a conscious decision to seek me out because of my race when they are making those remarks? And I think that's not true either.
So are you asking that we overrule Allen versus
No. No, Your Honor. I think that Allen and Belinsky remain good law. I think that Allen and Belinsky stand for the proposition that words alone may constitute the crime of terroristic threatening. But I think that we need to go further in that interpretation. In those cases of Allen and Belinsky and others, those were, I believe, 81 and 82 cases, and others that have come before the court since then, the terroristic threat was a rather obvious one. So that in Allen, for instance, holding a knife to a young lady's throat, having taken her clothes off and about to rape her, and to say, how would you like to live, has that person been selected, should the speaker, Allen, have reasonably foreseen that his words would be taken as a serious threat? And I think they would have. Likewise, in Belinsky, the threat to blow up a bank and kill people, should Belinsky have reasonably foreseen that those words would be taken as a serious threat of injury? I think that he should have. I think taking the true threat argument and applying it to Allen and Belinsky, those people would have still been convicted. But the problem, Your Honors, I think, on those things, that over the years, since those two decisions have come down, we've gotten to the point, at least in the trial courts, where we have become somewhat blasé about the use of words alone. To a great extent, on a day-to-day basis, we look at it and we say, well, mere words are sufficient for the crime, and no other examination is required as to the context in which those words were said. So that, for instance, under our statute, there's no requirement that the person hear the threat. There is no requirement, for instance, that they take it seriously. And I'm not suggesting that this court should impose those two requirements. However, I think that there should be that examination within the entire context of the speaking to determine whether it was a true threat, whether there was a reasonable expectation that those words would have been taken as a genuine threat to commit a crime.
Why isn't this a remedy for the General Assembly if the crime is overbroad? Why shouldn't they narrow it?
Well, Your Honor, I think that those things have been attacked previously on overbroad areas, and I'm not suggesting that this is necessarily overbroad. I am suggesting that the court can basically take that whole history of Supreme Court decisions from Watts running through RAV, Planned Parenthood, and say, yes, the statute is valid and a threat is required, but indeed it just must be a true threat.
I'm having a little bit of difficulty here because I don't understand why this is not a true threat.
In this particular case, ma'am?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because the facts, I believe, support the idea that there was not a true threat. Should Jason, this young man suffering from various problems of mental disturbance, have reasonably foreseen that his disciplinarian would have believed that they were a real threat? We have a strong history and a strong record, Your Honor, of this child being removed, for instance, from the Cape Henlopen School District because of outrageous statements that he made to a teacher there. He came into the COPS program in Sussex County with that knowledge. Everyone in the program knew that. And his behavior from the beginning was reprehensible verbally. He said things to anyone who was a disciplinarian, and he didn't discriminate, though, on the basis of race. So, for instance, from the very beginning, and actually from age six, this young man used the N-word in referring to not only the black victim in this case, but also his mother. And clearly, she was a white woman.
As I understood the record, Austin admitted that he wanted to frighten Edwards in order for Edwards to, as he said, quote, leave him alone, close quote. Now, if he uttered the words in order to make someone leave him alone, why wouldn't he have reason to believe that his words would frighten them?
Well, I think, Your Honor, yes, I agree that he admitted that he, in a sense, wanted that person to back off. If he didn't use those words exactly. But he had said those things before, and that person had indeed backed off in their disciplinary role. And if we look at, again, in the whole context, if that person was genuinely threatened, the victim here said, testified, I never believed him, but that day I did. He didn't have him arrested. The disciplinarian was trained in various holds and basket holds and that type of thing. He could have restrained this young man physically. He didn't do so. He could have isolated him in another part of the building. He didn't do so. He didn't frisk him down for weapons because he didn't believe he had a weapon. And nothing happened. The child went and finished his entire day at 11 o'clock. He left school as planned. And continued on, not having any idea that his words had been taken any other way. The victim here didn't go, for instance, to the Milton Police Department later and say, gosh, you know, I've got this kid, I live in Milton, he knows I live in Milton, I'm concerned. That never happened. A committee met at some point and charges were brought. And he was arrested 18 days later. And As I think, hopefully, I corrected in the briefs, there was some implication this child was removed from school the day that the incident occurred, and that's not what happened. He continued in the COPS program for a minimum of at least 6 more months. His trial in this matter was held in April, I believe, of 2005. And at the close of that, the teacher, the purported victim, said, willing to continue to work with Jason because I've been doing that all along. If you look at everything in that context, should he have reasonably believed his statements would have been reasonably foreseen, excuse me, that his statements would be believed? They never have been. He hadn't been charged with a crime. Nothing had ever happened to this young man as a result of his statements. And if you look at the evidence subsequent to those statements, they tend to support the idea that he was not believed on that occasion. Now, I think everything must be examined in context. There are some First Amendment cases that seem, for instance, so obvious to us. First Amendment flag burning protection, for instance. We automatically think, well, gosh, that's a protected right no matter what. But in the face of, for instance, a no burning local ordinance during the height of fire season, may the burning of a flag be prescribed? I believe so. I believe there are actually cases that have set forth that principle. So that even though on the face of it, a protected area, if we don't examine those within the context, then I think that we've gotten away from the thrust of the First Amendment. Your Honor, on the hate crime aspect, I believe that I've said that I'm proposing a definition here, that the person makes that conscious decision to seek out the victim because of their race. Obviously, that's not in the statute, that's not in the wording, and we've not found anything like that. And in all of the reported cases having to do with hate crime, such as the Wisconsin case, the Mississippi burning case, and RAV versus St. Paul, those are very obvious examples of selection. In the Mississippi burning case, those young men watched that movie, became very much inflamed as a result of it, went outside and made specific statements, or something to the effect of, are you all ready to act on some white people? And then later, not even immediately, but later, said, there goes a white boy, go get him. That's, I think, a very obvious example of a conscious decision to seek out the victim because of their race. Whereas in our present case, the victim and the defendant were placed in that room purely by happenstance. The victim happened to be black, and the defendant was striking out at him because he was a disciplinarian and not because he was a black man. If we don't have some kind of a standard that we basically wrap around that definition of select, then we end up in a situation where almost every time where the defendant and the victim are of a different race or a different national origin or a different sexual orientation, that we start out with an assumption that it must have been a hate crime just because the defendant and the victim are of a different race. We must have something that is more than happenstance. And happenstance.
Is it a complete history of happenstance?
I'm sorry, sir?
Is it a complete history of happenstance? Didn't the trial judge refer to prior events where there had been a so-called selection?
There had been, the trial judge referred to prior instances where racial statements had been made?
Yes.
Yes. And in this particular case, there is only one black disciplinarian in the school district, in that COPS program.
And so is it the flip side of your argument then would be that if there's a scenario where there's one racial minority in an institution, that anything goes because that's one racial minority? And
no. You know, I don't think. I think all of these circumstances have to be looked at totally within a context. So using my original analogy, do I think that I can be terroristically threatened as a public defender? Yes, I do. Do I think I can be a victim of a hate crime? Yes, I do. In probably 95% of the circumstances, and I don't want the court to think that I'm suggesting this happens all the time with my clients, but in 95% of the circumstances when that does happen, I think that most of us would logically look at that and say, that's not terroristic threatening. Would that person have reasonably believed his statement would be taken that way? Or did he select Dean, or was it someone in an office that assigned me and that person and were there purely by happenstance? I think it's a contextual answer, Your Honor.
Do you want to reserve the balance of your time?
Thank you very much, if I may.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, James Wakely on behalf of the State of Delaware. I think what Mr. Johnson has done is dance around what was actually said and what actually happened on this date. And so I would like to return to the facts of what happened on this particular day. Justin Austin was sitting in class and was told to perform an assignment. He resisted and was told that he would be given a two-minute violation whereby he would be timed out for that two-minute period.
What do you mean he resisted?
He refused to do the assignment. Verbally.
So you don't mean resisted in a physical
sense? No, Your Honor. He refused to do the assignment, which, given the nature of the COPS program, apparently is not uncommon, which is why they have the timeout and clock out options available. Mr. Austin was confronted by his Caucasian female teacher, Diane Wheeler, and was told, and at this point he began to be more and more aggressive in terms of his vocalizations of his opposition to doing the assignment. Ms. Wheeler asked Mr. Edwards, the behavioral manager, to remove Mr. Austin from the classroom. As of this point, Mr. Austin had not yet begun his racial invective. He had not been threatening in any particular way, simply had refused to do the assignment. Mr. Edwards removed him to another room, at which point the character of the language changed substantially. It, instead of being, I don't want to do this, it's, I hate this in school, I hate this in place, it's a waste of my time, you should go back to Africa, to be directed at Mr. Edwards, and I have a shotgun in the back of my car, and I will blow your brains out. That could hardly be characterized as anything approaching the circumstances under which the true threat doctrine was created by the United States Supreme Court in Watts. In fact, if you look at relevant case law from the Third Circuit in United States versus COSMA, the court developed three factors in which to consider whether it was indeed a true threat.
Why do we look to federal law on this at all?
Well, Your Honor, this is mostly because this is an issue that has not been fully fleshed out under Delaware law and by this court, as well as the true threat doctrine was developed in federal court. It mostly came about because of the threats to the president. Watts specifically was a threat.
Well, is it developed out of some constitutional law principle, like a statute's overbroad in its face, or what's the root of it that would cause us to analyze this situation in light of what does or does not constitute a true threat?
Well, given that there are certain circumstances where I could envision, even with the existing terroristic threatening statute that Delaware has, it could be considered a First Amendment protected issue. One would assume that the First Amendment protections would trickle down to the Delaware statute in addition to the threat against the president's statute that was at issue in COSMA and in Watts. Returning to the categories that the factors that COSMA went through, it was the political context of the statement, and I don't think that there can be any real argument that the statements here were not political in any particular manner. The statements were not conditional, as COSMA's statements were not in his case, and Watts' statements clearly were.
If one of the statements in the federal cases was something along the lines, if I had a rifle, LBJ would be the first one in my crosshairs, would that violate the Delaware terroristic threatening statute?
On its face, perhaps. Given the First Amendment protections, however, it's unlikely. The statute was, or that particular statement in Watts was conditional on being drafted into the Army, being given a rifle, and the first person he would want to get in his sights was LBJ. And that brings us to the third factor of COSMA, which was the audience to which this was directed.
Well, before we move on, if it doesn't violate the Delaware statute, is it because the Delaware statute has the true threat requirement within it?
Within the meaning of the true threat doctrine as developed by the Supreme Court, it certainly, the Delaware statute clearly...
In the United States Supreme Court?
By the United States Supreme Court, I apologize. The Delaware statute clearly incorporates the idea that certain statements may not be a true threat in that they are protected by the First Amendment. What Mr. Austin has attempted to do here is to expand the true threat doctrine and to challenge the Delaware statute on overbreath. And if you look at the Kentucky case, the Thomas that I cited, where we have a statute in Kentucky that is very similar to the Delaware statute, requires no intent to instill fear in the audience, requires no reasonableness on the part of the listener. That court found that the true threat doctrine didn't cover this particular statement. It didn't read this reasonable speaker aspect into it. And I think if you look at the clear intent of the legislature here when confronted with comparable statutes in other states with the model penal code, they obviously intended not to include a reasonable speaker or reasonable listener exemption to the terroristic threatening statute. And clearly here, the words are a threat that would reasonably entail death or serious injury. Now, moving on to the issue of selection, the court below, in its learned opinion, found that there had been a long history between these two of racial invective being targeted from Mr. Austin to Mr. Edwards. And that's clearly something that can be considered by the court under Wisconsin v. Mitchell, the United States Supreme Court case. The fact is that the selection was evident in that the person most directly disciplining Mr. Austin was Diane Wheeler, was not Willie Edwards. Willie Edwards was selected for this particular invective, this particular threat, because he was black. These words were directed at him because he was black. And even if there was an alternative explanation that he was selected because he was the only one there, this court in Williams said that even an alternative explanation which suggests innocence may be rejected if the court believes the other explanation implying guilt. Clearly, Mr. Austin, even if he used these words towards his mother, used these words in this context towards Mr. Edwards and not towards Ms. Wheeler. And that's clearly evidence that he intended to select Mr. Edwards based on his race.
But wasn't Mr. Edwards the one who was imposing the discipline?
Ms. Wheeler was the one who initiated the discipline. Mr. Edwards was the one, I would describe it as containing Mr. Austin. In this case, there wasn't, it was a separation from the classroom setting that Mr. Edwards was designed, his purpose was to ensure the separation to keep him timed out.
But what I'm trying to get at is that we have an out-of-control teenager. You'll agree he was an out-of-control teenager.
Certainly, Your
Honor. And the person who is being given the task of removing him and maintaining discipline is not Ms. Wheeler, it's Mr. Edwards, right?
That is true, Your Honor.
So doesn't it kind of follow logically that if this out-of-control teenager is going to let loose on somebody, it's going to be the person who's disciplining him and not the other person who may have started the process but is not actively involved in dealing with him at that moment?
That implies a sense of predetermination that he was going to explode no matter what. He began with Miss Wheeler. He began his out-of-control behavior with her, and it was only once Mr. Edwards became involved that he exploded even further and began using the racial statements and the direct threat.
Well, it's the fact that I'm not clear enough on, but I thought that it was only when Mr. Wheeler got involved Mr. Edwards got involved that there was any real effort being made to impose discipline, that the initial situation was you need a timeout, and then he wasn't taking his timeout, so Mr. Edwards came to say, yeah, you're taking a timeout, and we're going to see to that. I mean, is that more or less correct or not?
My understanding of the way that this operates is that Ms. Wheeler is in control of the situation and directs Mr. Edwards to remove him from the classroom once he had been sufficiently disruptive to raise her concerns. She asked Mr. Edwards to remove Mr. Austin from the classroom.
Okay, but the point I'm trying to make is that there seems to be a very different level of both authority being exercised and a direct contact with Mr. Austin as between the two disciplinarians, to the point that one of them really, it seems as if, had passed off the job to the second one. And the second one was dealing with the problem of getting the defendant under control. So if that's a fair statement of what was transpiring and the sequence of events, isn't it correct that Ms. Wheeler was more or less out of the picture by the time Mr. Edwards was dealing with the defendant, and that he was the only person for the defendant to lash out at, and as opposed to having selected Mr. Edwards rather than Ms. Wheeler?
By the time Mr. Austin made the statement, that's correct. Ms. Wheeler, according to her testimony and the testimony of Mr. Edwards, Ms. Wheeler was either in the doorway or just outside the doorway recording the events that occurred, but at the time, the person most directly interacting with Mr. Austin was Mr. Edwards. But
the difficulty here is the statute doesn't help us understand what the legislature meant by selects. It's an undefined term. And what raises a question in my mind is, if we change the facts slightly, and Mr. Austin burst into the faculty lounge, having escaped from imminent punishment, and there were six teachers there, five Caucasians and one African-American, and Mr. Austin selected from the group of six the one African-American and then used the epithets that he used toward Mr. Edwards in this case. we wouldn't have an issue about selects for the purpose of saying I'm going to blow your brains out and I have a shotgun in the trunk of my car. Or if he'd run down the street and selected teachers on their way back from the parking lot or whatever. But in this situation, how does selects operate to say that under these circumstances, Mr. Austin engaged in a hate crime because he specifically selected Mr. Edwards for the kind of abuse that Mr. Edwards was unfortunately subjected to?
Well, Your Honor, returning to the Dorner decision below, Mr. Austin had the choice of exploding at Ms. Wheeler and didn't do so. He didn't do so until he was removed from what's called the initial stressor of Ms. Wheeler trying to impose the assignment on him. And he was separated from that. He didn't explode until he was with Mr. Edwards by himself.
But he didn't select Mr. Edwards. He selected forms of abuse that were uniquely, I hate to use the word for fear of somebody drawing the wrong inference, uniquely applicable to Mr. Edwards as Mr. Austin saw it at the time. Is that sufficient to make it a hate crime?
Well, if you return to what Justice Ridgely stated, that would be true in any situation when you had a group of one. If you have, in this case, he selected his victim, he selected the person to whom he was going to explode, and to whom he was going to threaten. He could have threatened Ms. Wheeler, but he threatened Mr. Edwards. And there is an inherent selection process in that he had the choice of selecting either one of them. The timing of it makes it a more difficult circumstance that it was shortly after he was removed from Ms. Wheeler's presence. But he had the choice of exploding at both or either of them.
Yeah, I take your point.
And well, if he had threatened both of them with blowing their brains out with a shotgun, then there would not be a hate crime.
It would have been a far more difficult case under those circumstances with regard to Mr. Wheeler. If he had directed racial statements at both of them as a group, then it would have certainly been a difficult case. If, however, he said, I'm going to blow your brains out, and was targeting Mr. Edwards for all this other racial invective, you could certainly make the case that he selected Mr. Edwards in addition because of his race, given that his role in the classroom was largely as a manager of behavior and not as an instructor or independent disciplinarian.
No matter where someone is placed involuntarily, is there a selection that can be made if they're there involuntarily?
I would suggest that the selection occurs at the time to explode. If he's taken separately and separated from the context and then explodes 10 minutes later, then let me return to what I was saying. He made his choice when he chose not, when Ms. Wheeler instructed Mr. Edwards to remove him from the classroom. At that point, it had not elevated to the point where it was threatening and it was racially based. It was not until later. If this were a circumstance where Mr. Edwards had removed him for some other reason, they were in a room separately, and Mr. Austin exploded, that would have been a different circumstance. The fact is that the issues here began in the classroom, began with Ms. Wheeler, and ended with Mr. Austin, and they only became explosive and threatening with Mr. Edwards and not with Ms. Wheeler. If the court has no further questions, thank you very much.
Excuse me, may it please the court. I was thinking of an example of reversing this fact pattern only slightly, and that's this. Jason and the disciplinarian, and I emphasize disciplinarian, he's not a teacher. He's there for one sole purpose. Ms. Wheeler is a teacher. He's a disciplinarian. But Jason and the disciplinarian are in the room, and they're getting in each other's face, as they clearly were. And Mr. Edwards says, you know, I can't deal with this kid any longer. I've had it. You try. And walks out of the room, and Ms. Wheeler comes into the room. And Jason follows him out, continues making racial slurs and threats against him. We're, I think, then getting into a selection where that child made a conscious decision to go out of that room and follow that man down and make those statements because of his race. I'm not suggesting he could get convicted ultimately, but do we have a better case at that point for the selection process to have occurred? And I think we do.
Well, what's wrong with the argument and analysis that the state just suggested, that in this factual context, the selection took place on the basis of timing? Austin concluded not to explode and threaten Ms. Wheeler, but then chose to explode and threaten the African-American disciplinarian. Why isn't that a selection in the time continuum?
Because I think, Your Honor, that the evidence is so strong that timing is not what motivated the young man to make his statements. It's authoritarian. It's discipline. His history that was undisputed is that if his mother was acting as the disciplinarian, he called her the N-word. He called her a crack whore. When Ms. Wheeler had acted as the disciplinarian and not the teacher, he called her a crack whore. He struck out at people that were in front of him in the best way that he could, or the most effective way he felt to get their attention and get them to stop and back off. Mr. Edwards happened to be black. And he happened to have been in the room, not with Ms. Wheeler in there, just the disciplinarian and Jason. He had no choice as to who he was placed with. He wished to strike out, and he had a black man standing in front of him. So he did. Your Honor, one other thing that I wanted to note, there was a question, I think, about the Watts decision and whether, for instance, had there been a prosecution under the Delaware statute, I think the question was, would there have been a conviction? And I think that there would have been, or there could have been. If you look at it purely that the Delaware statute requires words alone, did the young man say, if they put a gun in my hands, the first thing I'll get in my sights is LBJ? Yes, he did. On the face of it, that's all that's sufficient under the present circumstances. But Watts clearly ultimately was determined that it was not a crime, that it was mere political hyperbole. But to come to that decision, they had to look at the whole thing in its context. Did he say the words? Yes. Were they a direct threat to injure or kill? Yes. But it was during a political rally in Washington, D.C., at the height of the Vietnam trauma tearing the country apart, and the court looked at all of those things.
But the court was looking there to basically find a way to protect political speech.
Yes.
There's no issue of political speech here.
No, I don't think that on its face there is, but there at least is arguably some First Amendment questions that are impacted, yes. Is Jason normally allowed to use the N-word? Yes, he is. Can he go around telling people that his family is in the KKK and his uncle is in the mob? And can he do that? And at least on first blush, protected speech? Certainly there is.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you.
Counsel, we'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.